Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. Episode 431 of the Roguecast, recorded September 12th, 2023. Cobra's Weed Cannon. All right, after 2 weeks out, we're back. I've been dealing with some sick stuff, and
illness in general was floating around, and we were being extra cautious and having some people stay home.
So that craziness.
We don't want to risk people, but now we're all here again.
Yes,
and our powers united.
Yes,
we're going to form Captain Planet.
Also, our staff has grown.
That is true. That is true. Even as one of the staffers leaving, we've got two replacements coming in.
Like Hydra.
It's like Hydra, that's right. You cut off one rogue, two more rogues take his place. Yeah. But please don't cut off any rogues.
No, please don't cut off any rogues' heads.
We don't want to deal with four rogues. No, but the training is going well, and our new staffers seem dope. But it's nice to get back together because there have been some cool developments where there's actually trailers to talk about.
We've all been watching some TV, some like video games,
and there's some good comics this week.
And there's a couple of good weeks of comics, so we're gonna talk about that. Before we talk about that, there's also been a bunch of games lately.
Okay.
First of all, we have our board game clearance sale. This is a new thing we're trying this year. Started off on Labor Day. It's going to run through all September.
Yep.
We are clearing out some games we haven't sold in a little while. There's some good games on the table. It is 50% off.
Yeah, this is like no little baby discount.
It's a good time to you want to pick up some games with an eye towards giving stuff away for holidays.
Yes.
People will not know you got it 50% off, and you'll be like the big spender.
That's true. Look like the hero you're not.
The hero they deserve.
Yeah.
There's some good stuff in there. There's that game, Tuankinkatsu, whatever it is.
Yes.
It is like
it's hard to pronounce, but good to play.
Building an Incan game. Mm-hmm. There's Origins First Builders, which is the notion of like alien archaeologist kind mm-hmm. of things. There's a whole bunch of good games over on there.
Yeah, and people have been picking them up. they definitely started diving at it. But it's a pretty extensive sale, so there's a lot of selections.
Yep.
So you should come in, but, you know, come in sooner rather than later.
Yep, for sure. We got the new Villainous expansion for Star Wars, Scum and Villainy.
Uh-huh.
Which features Boba Fett. I'm not sure who else is in there, actually. Anybody know?
I mean, I'm sure it's Cad Bane and a couple
of... Oh, Cad Bane makes sense, yeah.
I mean, you could put any of the bounty hunters in there, right. Forlom or Zuckuss. Or
man, there's a Zuckuss in there.
Yeah, go on.
I don't know. No, I got nothing. Dengar. Dengar's great.
I mean, I feel like in comparison, Dengar is like a superstar and Zuckuss is like an up-and-comer.
Why are you always maligning Zuckuss?
He's a Z-lister. It's right there, his name, Zuckuss.
Randy put it best, I think. 2 seconds
And honestly, Forlom and Zuckusses are a package deal.
Hey, you don't get the Zuckuss without getting the Forlom.
You know what's funny is they got exactly about as much screen time in Empire Strikes Back.
Yes.
None of them said anything or anything like that. But those guys got toys later.
Yep.
And for that reason, they will forever be also-rans to me. Zuckuss and who's the other one?
Forlom.
And Forlom, yes.
Which one's the insect and which one's the robot?
Zuckuss is the insect, Forlom is the robot.
He's got a four in his name.
But it's like an insectoid robot, too. It's like a weird kind of...
Yep. Well, you know,
there's a backstory
one,
for
there's
it.
There's that one that was in the that was in the Sandcrawler with 3PO and stuff, and he's got a slightly insectoid little snout.
No, that's just
face.
A Death Star droid.
Is that okay? Yeah, but like, why
that's
are they made
some
that?
Of the same...
But they also have, like, slightly insectoid bigger eyes. I think it's one of those, like at least retconned in, is that you know, is like the same way the aliens... The like droidicas are bait from like aliens that look sort of like that or something like that. So
well maybe there's just one robot designer in Star Wars who's just really into bugs.
Just the actual droid designer.
Yeah, he's like, I like bugs.
He's like, C-3PO was almost had giant anime eyes.
Yes. They're supposed to have antenna and they're like, you can't. You just can't do it.
Just big giant bee eyes.
Like, but my bug droids!
The robotic June bug was a cool idea, but
then he did the robot cicada, and that was a little scary.
No,
that
would be
shrieks.
The coolest of the cool.
It shrieks and shreds its armor. Anyway.
For people who don't know, How much do I like cicadas? Back when I was playing City of Heroes, the MMO for superhero stuff in the early 2000s, I had a character named Mighty Cicada. He might have been somewhat loosely based on the Tick, a big doofus insect hero. Anyway,
Did he shriek?
He did. He had sonic powers. He could shatter things apart with his sonic stuff, which makes a whole lot more sense than the cicada that Geoff Johns created for Flash, who's just like some serial killer cultist.
That is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta have sonic powers and flight and just shriek until people's eardrums burst.
Exactly. Anyway, we also got...
Sorry for the cicada aside.
We also got the G.I. Joe RPG Cobra Codex.
Oh yeah, that's pretty cool.
This lets you play as like one of the colorful Cobra like mercenaries type.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. Which honestly, Cobra always looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean you can't be a Falconer and you can't be a Crocmaster because I already got that. But if you want to be their guy, who's like their Badger guy, you could be their Badger guy.
I think I would have fun coming up with. I could be the Cobra Whipmaster.
Cobra Whipmaster.
They're evil tobogganist.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
An evil tobacconist. He's just selling weed. Jeez, Cobra. They're on the schoolyard. Just
oh no.
Cobra got to make money for all the big terror drones.
Got a hook over Cobra Commander, and there's just smoke pouring off under his helmet.
Oh my god. I'm 420.
Oh god. Destro my weed cannon will slow
on. I'll bring bliss to the cities, then they'll be easy to conquer.
Did we say we might be a little loopy today?
There's something I don't even know what it is. It's not particularly not hot sure in here or anything today. It's actually very nice in here.
This is like a lot of fun. The G.I. Joe RPG is a blast. That we've played a little bit of it.
Yes.
And this idea of like playing Cobra. The rule book is also fun because you read through and it's from the Cobra point of view, and it's like basically how the Joes are the real bad guys.
Oh, nice.
The we're throwing off the shackles of authoritarianism and all this kind of
stuff. That's fun. That's
kind of fun.
Cobra propaganda is good stuff.
Renegade also put out Werewolf the Apocalypse, the popular werewolf game from the World of Darkness.
Been around since the 90s, and I understand that after like some false starts occasionally in rebirthing some of them, that they've been doing quite a good job lately.
Yeah, well, and this particular is interesting because werewolves are supposed to be sort of the defenders of Gaia.
And that's right. So, there's this environmental aspect, right?
In the 90s, it was one thing. Now it's like they're like fighting a losing battle against corporations and that kind of thing.
Right.
And you will definitely be playing like werewolf apocalyptian type thing. They're trying to stop climate change from being a thing and that kind of thing. And I'm like, there's some interesting stuff to play in there.
I have to admit, I would like to tear out the throat of a CEO like anybody else.
Indeed. We got a Boop.
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
Boop.
Okay, what's that?
So remember there's this game, Boop, where you're like, you're two cats and you're trying to knock you off the bed?
Yes.
So this is the spooky version of it.
I like it.
As in Boo.
Like a little Halloween? Boop. Little adorable Halloween version?
It is like the new Flamecraft. Everybody's super hyped for it.
Oh, really? This is not just like some weird novelty game.
No.
This one introduces ghost cats.
Ghost cats.
I'm in favor.
We got MCU Infinity Saga Trivia from the same people that made the D&D Trivia. So this is like it's all like 20 movies. I'm very tempted with this. I think that looks super cool.
Randy, the other day I found just online a sample card, probably the official sample card from the D&D one, and it is pretty tough. People had told me it was tough. But I feel like on the card, I think I knew about half of them. I had to guess at a few. And I was wrong on some of those guesses.
Yeah.
But remind me later on to run it past you. But it was fun, and I think that like an MCU specifically?
MCU specifically.
That sounds like a blast. A lot of people have a pretty solid knowledge of that now.
We also got from the same company, Express Route, or as Nick calls it, the Amazon game. This is a game, it's a co-op game where you're trying to do deliveries and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And it is a... I've played this a little bit at Gamma. It's really fun. It's very stressful. It's like tougher than Pandemic, I think.
Oh, wow.
But it looks like a very cool co-op.
Depending on how people do, like how kind of well their groups, I guess, cohere on these things, I've heard people say that Pandemic is way too hard. And it is always a challenge. Like, I feel like maybe when we played it more regularly, I felt like we lost a little more than we won.
We lost the Pandemic Legacy, but Pandemic, we got pretty good at it.
But that's what I was thinking. I was like, we got pretty solid at Pandemic.
Yeah. Maybe people are just bad at games.
I didn't want to say it, but...
Or maybe we're super awesome at them.
Oh, okay, let's go in that direction.
Yeah.
But yes, this one sounded weird to me because I'm like, I can't quite picture it as like, it's somebody, I'm the UPS driver and I'm
No, you've got trucks and planes and trains. And uh-huh. you have to use those sparingly to like travel from different places. And then you get like, you get stuff that has to go to a certain destination.
Okay.
And the packages keep coming in. So like, if you don't deliver your packages, you will get overwhelmed.
It is like I Love Lucy with the conveyor belt thing.
It is like sequence. That, yes.
Now, very often in co-op games, though, each person has like something that only they can kind of contribute or be good at. That's why I thought,
yes.
One person's a UPS or one person's
There is that sort of like dispatcher kind of thing and that kind of thing, yeah.
But anyway, the main thing is just that the word is very good on the game.
Yeah, it's really good. I really liked it. I'm looking forward to playing it again.
And it's called Amazon. No, it's not called Amazon.
It's called Express Route. It is not the Amazon game.
Right. Express Route.
There are other people that do shipping.
Yep. But that's why I wanted to say it again.
But if I call it the Amazon, UPS, FedEx, what else is there?
Post office.
USPS.
Game.
Game. It's a
Express
long
route,
title.
Though. That's okay. Just wanted to get that out Express there for the audience.
We also got the Pathfinder Hero deck. This is the tarot deck of the Pathfinder world.
Yep.
These are super cool, by the way. They're all foil, beautiful new art. You can use them in game, but they're also just like, it's just a cool deck of art cards.
Yep. If you just wanted cool tarot cards or just the cool art of it all, or you like a Pathfinder universe and lore and all that, which is, it's a good universe.
There's a new game, Lord of the Rings Adventures of Mount Doom, which I think is a two-player.
Oh, okay.
I think. I'm not positive on this.
I'm not sure.
But it's a new game. I feel like it's co-op. I didn't look carefully enough at this. But it's Reiner Knizia.
Google it, people.
It's another one of those.
Cool.
We got several murder mystery parties. We got somebody doing a repackaging of those. And mm-hmm. So there's like some new murder mystery party games.
It seems like it could be timely. Like a good thing to run in October, I would guess.
I would think so. Murderous popular in October.
Absolutely.
We got Catan Starfarers, New Encounters expansion. This is our second expansion for Catan Starfarers. We got Black Hole Buccaneers, which is a game I don't know a ton about.
Okay.
Looks cool. The Sorcerer's Epic Alliance, which is the Disney, like...
Sorcerer's Arena.
Yeah.
Is the main game. That's where you have, like, you'll build, like, a little team of, like, three Disney characters that are kind of your... It's not like quite like a gladiator game because it's not like violent really or anything, but you are battling other teams.
It's like it's not unlocked. What's the games that we get the
it's
unmatched?
Unmatched.
Oh right.
So this is kind of like Unmatched, but with Disney characters.
That is how I thought about it. Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, the new expansion features Mulan, Robin Hood, and Mrs. Potts.
Yes, which led us to wonder how, but. I literally was just yesterday or the day before talking with our staffer John, who has played the game, tells me it's fun, and I hope to try it out soon. He has purchased this, so he liked it enough to buy it with his own money.
Oh.
And he says that, like, that Mrs. Potts can actually do some cool things on the field. I feel like she's kind of, like, area control and issuing commands and maybe even, like little sort of buffs and stuff like that.
Well, she also blinds you with hot tea.
And she will, like,
she will
burn
you
away.
Yep.
Yes,
yep.
And then launches chip at you.
She'll throw her son in a second.
Yeah. Oh, mom, no! Sorry, son.
We need some caltrops. That means your shattered body.
I can always make more. What?
I have a whole set.
She's had her eye on that Keurig.
We got a game called My Island, which is based on 2020's My City. It's a competitive legacy game in which you develop your own unique island from connected hexagons over 24 games.
Cool.
This looks very cool. I was like the legacy game style thing.
Mm-hmm.
There is another game I feel is a reprint called Mystic Market. And then a couple sort of party-ish game, a new version of Exploding Kittens called Good vs. Evil, which has a whole new set of cards. Without Fail, which is the same publisher, and Really Loud Librarians, which I think has got to be like the caveman yelling game.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like a party game kind of thing, yeah.
And then I should mention we got new D&D figures for Zarak, which I think is their rogue.
Oh, yeah, these are like, you're talking action figures, not the usual miniatures.
They're action figures.
They're put out through NECA.
Kind of the prestige sort of action figures.
They've previously done Warduke and, what's the evil dude? What's the other guy?
Oh, the snake guy.
He was one I didn't really know. These new two, I had the original Grimsword. I had the original figure of both of them. I had Strongheart the Paladin, and this is like such a much cooler version of him. Among the many cool things in it is like his sword has like kind of like a little sort of sheath for a dagger attached to its scabbard, so that the dagger sheathes alongside the scabbard. It just looks cool.
Yeah.
And the half-orc assassin, whatever.
Zarak.
Yeah, I have to tell you, as a kid, I thought it was the coolest thing in the world to have an action figure that was officially, per the box, an assassin. I was like, not just a rogue, you know, not just a little skeevy, an assassin.
Yep.
Young Dave was very into assassins, where old Dave is not into assassins.
That's true. That's true.
Dave has outgrown assassins.
Can you outgrow Zarak?
Not this one, though. He's very cool looking, and Nick and I were looking at the figure earlier, and aside from coming with his little, having his little assassin daggers, which kind of look like little throne daggers, like, what's his name in
Machete?
And Machete.
Desperado.
And Desperado is what I was thinking, though. He's got like a little bottle of what is surely meant to be poison for them.
Maybe this is aspirin.
I don't think it is. It's a liquid. It's
red boiling liquid.
Maybe it's Pepto. It's Pepto Bismol for when his tum-tum's giving him trouble.
Yes.
He also has a grappling hook.
Yeah. It is a very cool version of this figure. 1,000 times more detailed than the figure that I had in 1983 or whatever it was.
The Kenner style.
Yeah. What was interesting is they actually had ball and socket joints. They weren't particularly well made, but they didn't bend at the knees and elbows, but their arms could kind of move around a little bit more. They weren't these stiff toy soldiers of Kenner.
Yep.
But anyway, yes, very cool figures. If you do any sort of fantasy figures or just if you're nostalgic like I am or want some cool D&D figures, probably worth checking out.
Yep.
All right, so let's talk about the comics the first couple weeks of September, this week and last week. Let's start with a crossover. I think, Dave, this was not on either of our radar. We both kind of wound up liking it.
Yes.
It is Batman, Catwoman, The Gotham War, which starts off with this one-shot called Battle Lines.
And it's overall like a mini-series that's going to be like just like 8 issues long, or like a crossover,
it's,
I mean.
2 issues each of Batman and Catwoman, and then 4 one-shots.
Yep. And in its way, it reminds me of when Mark Miller did Civil War over at Marvel. Not like in all the specifics, but just in the sense of, you know how everybody like knew what the battle lines were? It's like, oh, Iron Man is like, we need law and order. We gotta like get these superheroes registered. And Cap is like, that's not for you to say. I'm here for civil liberties. The heroes who stay masked are with me. And you knew who was what, and there were a lot of fun internet conversations and stuff about it and arguments. Okay, so this has a similar thing where, because of the events that happened in Night Terrors, Batman was essentially sidelined for like almost 2 months. And as he comes back and gets going again in Gotham, he's like, oh, but Catwoman's like, I've been doing things a little differently. And what she has done is a lot of the guys who are like the henchmen for like the criminals like Two-Face and Joker and Freeze and stuff like that, very recidivist people who like, they go to jail, they get released, they just hook up with another mob again. She not only did she spring some of them, but she's been training them to be like elite cat burglars like her, like really skilled at what they do. But she's got this very strict set of codes. She's like, I will teach you these skills, but you only steal from the rich. Mm. You never have confrontations. No killing whatsoever. No even confrontations.
No violence. Yeah.
No violence. And 15% of the take goes to Gotham charities. And so Batman comes back and like violent crime is down like 75%.
Yep.
And she's like, she knows that this is probably going to be a problem. So she calls a meeting of sort of the Bat family. And she said, listen, she's like, this is a thing I'm doing and I'd really like you guys to get on board.
I thought that was an interesting way to do it. Basically, they go to like her club or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And she just has them all at tables and is like, they don't do the thing of like she and Batman like jump across the rooftops and have a discussion. It's like, no, she calls them into a room and
she wants all the whole family on board. And also I suspect she knew that some of them would be with her, and that's because, and if she just did it with Batman, he'd be like, are you insane?
Yeah, yeah. And their Batman is interesting because he is dealing with the Batman of Zurin, that is in his head, the pure Batman that Morrison sort of brought back and Zdarsky's used.
Right. That's a thing for, just in case you don't know, where, like, if he ever got, like, brainwashed or something like that, it was almost like an embedded personality that was, like, a really dedicated, hardcore Batman that would come out and sort of get him out of the situation.
But he is only about punishing criminals. He's got none of the nuance.
Right. And
He's just coming out of Night Terrors. He's been possessed by Bruce Wayne.
Right.
Brand.
He's not exactly at his best, so he is kind of like, you're insane.
He's lost his money. He also lost a hand, apparently. He's got, like, a robot hand now.
Yeah, that's something I didn't know about. It's really relatively irrelevant as far as the story goes.
He took that detour into Star Wars land. He's like, you lose a hand.
You get a robot hand. But it very much seems like Batman has been getting older, and they're doing a little bit of that, like, you know, what am I still trying to do? And then Catwoman presents this new way of doing things, but he is still resisting.
And he's immediately against it, and Damian's immediately against it.
Damian's a little jerk.
Damian's
only against it because his father's against it.
No,
Damian is like, all criminals should be punished.
He has a child's view of crime and punishment.
Yeah, Damian's a little I've gone back to thinking Damian's a little shit. Grant Morrison rescued him for me a little bit, but now I kind of hate him again.
I mean, I like the character. I can like the little shit. But interestingly, the other Bat families seem to be kind of with Batman, and they're like, look at the numbers, man. Yeah. But this is actually a fairly nuanced discussion where Nightwing's like, man, I don't know what to think on this. He's like, I can't just look the other way when I see these people doing, you know, cat burglary crimes. And he's like, you know, we can't just trade one crime for another. So that is what they look to discuss in this. And what I'm fascinated to see is, first of all, that I did kind of like that the Bat family seemed to be largely on Catwoman's side, because I think that's the correct side. But I know that the comic cannot come out and say, yeah, we should all just be robbing the rich. That's clearly the way to go. That is not what they're going to do. So what they have to do is there is some complications within it that happened even in the first issue. And it's some interesting complications. And I want to see how Chip Zdarsky and Tini Howard, those are the two writers, and, you know, they write, one writes Batman, one writes Catwoman stuff.
Yep.
How they're going to resolve it, and can they do it satisfyingly? I'm not 100% sure they can, but it's been an interesting ride. Nick, you've been enjoying it.
I've read both the issues.
The second chapter is Batman. It's another good chapter. I definitely am looking forward to seeing this go.
What is it, like, Catwoman, or who is it who said it's like Bruce is causing being a problem? What is it? He's like specifically going after her, like criminals or something like that, or cat burglars.
Yep.
And she's like, we've got to kind of distract Bruce. We need to hit him with his biggest failure, Jason Todd.
Yep.
And they come up with some interesting plans. It's an interesting war that's not like not like they see each other in the street and just start fighting, but it's more of a war of philosophies, but it's probably going to get to fighting at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a fight there between Nightwing and Robin and Red Hood and all those guys throwing down.
So that's true.
There's already some of that.
Batman already has thrown some wrinkles.
I like the scene where Red Hood followed Catwoman back to her house.
Yeah.
And he, like, just... He actually is kind of on her side.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, he's like, you've got to be more careful. If I could do this, Batman can. And she just starts kicking his ass. And then, like, a couple of her allies show up and start kicking his ass, too. And it's a good scene.
Also, the artwork on this. Mike Hawthorne does the one-shot.
Oh, yeah.
And Jorge Jimenez is still doing the Batman art. It's really nice.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I did not expect a small Batman crossover to grab me, but this one actually has some thought behind it.
Yeah, I wasn't going to read either.
If you want to see something that's a little going to challenge some of Batman's philosophy a little bit and include also the whole Bat family in smart ways, give the Gotham War a look.
But also, if you've been out of Batman for a while, you can jump into this and you're not missing anything. Like you say, Dave and I are both like, why does he have a robot hand? Doesn't matter.
They'll explain it.
Yeah,
or you'll find out as much as you need.
Or it will when it needs to be. But yeah, Blue Beetle gets to number one. This is Josh Trujillo, which I think did the last one.
I thought this was a solid first issue.
It is. Yeah. There's a couple different. There's like a yellow and a green beetle who are allies of his. There's a bunch of characters in here I don't know, but they're.
But there's also like his besties from El Paso have moved to, I believe, the fictional city. That's the one in the movie.
Yep, Palmera City,
and that's where they're all going to college, right? Yep.
There's also Ted Kord's in here, so that's good.
Yeah, and Ted Kord even shows up with some classic, like, 80s era, or probably 60s Charlton Blue Beetle villains. Yep. Was it the Mad Men?
Yeah, the Mad Men, yeah.
And I like that kind of callback.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool.
Also from the JLI files, we've got Fire and Ice, Welcome to Smallville.
Oh, yeah, I meant to read that, but I didn't get around to it yet.
I liked
read
this. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
It's goofy. Basically, after the... there was something that happened. Oh, is it one of the crossovers? Lazarus Planet, I think?
Maybe, or Heroes in Crisis, or
but
whatever.
Something happened where basically Fire and Ice besties, along with Elrond, the subservient robot.
Yep. Man, this is all going back to Justice League International, mm-hmm. late 80s, early 90s.
They move to Smallville, and the only room available, they buy a beauty emporium that Ice then decides they're going to run.
Yes.
And
they were in their way, if Beetle and Booster Gold were like Fred and Ricky, they were Lucy and Ethel.
For sure. Yeah. And Fire is basically like trying to start up she's like posting TikToks about how they're in Smallville now and they'll take on any villain. And Ice is like, I thought we were just going to run a nice beauty salon. but it's also like Martha Kent is one of their patrons here.
Yep.
Superman is the one who sort of got them a job. Like,
that's cute.
He's like, he's the one who put them in the town. And there's a little bit of division between the two of them over what they're doing. It's very cute. It's very fun.
Is this on the side of Cozy Adventure? Something like in that a little bit?
I would say that.
Really good artwork.
Nice artwork, yeah. Natasha Bustos from Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur.
Okay.
Super fun. Then another one I don't think any of us expected to like as much as we did, but Birds of Prey number one.
It's great.
That was actually maybe my favorite book in the last week or three.
It's excellent. And the thing is, Birds of Prey as a concept is one I think we all like.
Mm-hmm.
It was...
Originally, it was, what, Oracle and...
Oracle and Black Canary.
Black Canary, and then they would bring in mission specialists that were always the female heroes of the DC universe.
Then it became... Then they added Huntress.
Gail Simonia made it basically Huntress and Lady Blackhawk. And then now it's like, because of the movie... Harley Quinn's sort of associated with it, but this is Oracle cannot be involved for some reason, which I think is interesting.
Right, it's a plot point that is being revealed.
The opening sequence with Dinah and Ollie is great.
Yep. So Black Canary has to put together a team, and she puts together a team of Cassandra Cain, Big Barda, Zealot from the Wildcats universe, which is weird but kind of works.
Yep.
And Harley Quinn, and the reason they bring in Harley Quinn is really well done.
Yeah, they show this cool scene where. Isn't it Cassandra Cain makes the case?
Yeah,
yes.
It's really good.
And it's cool. It's very visual. The book has a sort of, what I can only think of as a slightly retro art style, and I don't mean to say it looks old-timey, but it does have a clean line art look for people if you like anything from like Darwin Cook to Javier Pulido, all those guys, Chris Samnee, all those guys who did Daredevil during Mark Waid's run. It's got that kind of vibe, and they look super cool.
Yeah, it looks great.
Like, Barda looks like she can kick ass in this, and she does.
Cassandra Cain's recruitment of Barda was probably my favorite thing in there.
Honestly, yeah. Cassandra Cain is my favorite part of this book. They really get her.
Yeah, and you know, I actually have liked her from the beginning when she was introduced in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of rare to see her particularly used well, especially since she is usually still on the quiet side. Yeah. That's kind of her thing.
Yeah.
She's a little ninja. But yeah, she is a great little sort of binding agent for all of this.
Barda's little bat.
Yeah, she calls her little bat. And I like the inclusion of a heavy hitter like Barda.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure how that would work, but the writing seems good. Well, this is Kelly Thompson writing, I think.
Kelly Thompson.
What do they say? Like, this is the kind of team that if you saw on the streets, you'd shit your pants. It was a good line.
It's pretty good. It's really fun. I did not expect to like it as much as I did, but I think we were all pretty impressed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of things we didn't expect to like as much as we did, we had Avengers Inc. this week.
Yep.
This is Al Ewing and Leonard Kirk.
And when last we discussed Al Ewing, we were kind of singing his praises
on Immortal Thor.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the same kind of, like, it's weird, this book is completely different from Immortal Thor.
Not remotely the same.
But in some ways, the same things I liked about Immortal Thor, which was respect for Marvel's history, an interesting, mystery going on.
Yep. It looks like six supervillains have been murdered by Scourge of the Underworld inside the Raft.
Yeah, and Scourge, if people remember, was like a pretty obscure character who I think we talked about him the other week.
We talked about him a lot. He's a vigilante who was killing off D-list villains.
Yes. Yeah, seemingly a way to just clean up Marvel's like villain list so that like when they did new Marvel Universe editions, the Handbook of the Marvel Universe, they wouldn't have to fill it up with a bunch of also-rans. But memorable for anybody who was reading in the 80s because like he would just show up in issues and just gun down various criminals. And indeed, it looks like that's what's happened in this, but there is like there's a whole lot of twists, even within the first issue. And Wasp, essentially, Janet Van Dyne, founding Avenger, has to put herself in an investigatorial role. And the interesting limitation is, right now, people in New York, no superheroes. This is a fallout from when the Kingpin was mayor. That law is still in effect. And so she's got to kind of plainclothes it, and she's kind of Dana Scully, right?
Yeah, she is. I'm
saying that partially just because she looks like it.
I like the way she's brought in, though, because you would not exactly think that this should be a Wasp thing.
I think we can sort of say it has something to do with one of her villains.
Yeah.
And she doesn't exactly have a big pantheon of villains, but one of the ones shows up, who's an Avengers general bad guy, too. She's brought in to consult.
Yeah, and I think it's a good tell of her character of, why she's doing this, because... Mm-hmm. And why she's an Avenger, a founding Avenger, the person who named the Avengers.
Well, and the thing is, Dave and I both came in or were reading during Roger Stern's tenure when she was the leader.
Right.
And so I'm primed to think of Janet as more than, the ditzy...
Right. In the 60s and 70s, she was kind of the ditzy society girl, but very much grew up in the 80s. And, what was I going to say? There's lots of... Just as in, Ewing's Thor, there's lots of positive, forward-thinking ideas in this that I think grow the Marvel Universe. So she's... What was the location she's got? The Avengers?
Jarvis Lounge.
This is like a kind of a... Watering hole for superheroes, yeah. And Jarvis is there,
Butler.
It was exciting to see Jarvis again.
Yep. Also, her partner in this, basically she's going to be solving superhero murder kind of things... is Victor Shade, but it is not the Vision.
Right. And that is, for people who haven't read any stories with that, Vic Shade is an alter ego of the Visions when he makes himself look like a human.
Yeah.
Yep.
And kind of lives a sort of normal life. And the Vision has so many weird incarnations and stuff that I don't know who this guy is, but I have some confidence that Al Ewing has a good story to tell with it.
Yeah,
for sure. The mystery's good, the art's good, that's definitely my pick this week.
We've also got a one shot Werewolf by Night just in time for September.
Yeah,
this is definitely patterned off the popular MCU one shot.
Yeah, the Disney Plus
because it is Bloodstone teamed up with Jack Russell Terrier.
Always funny.
And they're basically this guy Dr. Necromanta.
Or necromantic or something?
Necromantic,
yeah. That's his. Yeah, Dr. Necromantic has moved a castle from the Bavarian Alps to the Rockies. And so he's going there to investigate it. And so is Bloodstone.
Yeah, there's dark designs at work.
It's interesting because he is always in black and white, and Bloodstone's in full color.
And they're kind of like frenemies.
Yeah, they're kind of like friends and frenemies. It is a one-shot. It's definitely riffing on what they did in the one shot.
Yeah, if you had fun with that and would like to see these characters again, some cool art, and it's fun.
Yeah. There's also Spine Tingling Spider-Man, which is a horror one shot by Saladin Amid and artist Juan Ferreira, who is a really good artist. And it's Spidey fighting demons and zombies and possibly other stuff and maybe hallucinations.
If you would like to see a little more horror in Spider-Man, you might want to check this out. Nick, you did point me to a panel where Spider-Man punches the head off a zombie. And it's not it's more funny than it is gory.
Yeah.
This is not like a big super gore fest. I don't think it is anyway. But anyway, yeah, for September.
And then Alligator Loki is a one, I think this is also a one shot.
It is.
Yeah, it was. I know it was a digital first thing of
Okay.
Vignettes about...
It's akin to the Jeff the Land Shark that they did not too long ago.
If you by chance have a kid who is obsessed with Alligator Loki, or would be if you force them to watch Loki, then this is the book for you. It's a very cute kind of thing.
We got Batman Gargoyle of Gotham.
Which is Raphael Grandpa's foray into the Caped Crusader.
Yeah, he's... Raphael Grandpa is a... Where is he from? South America?
Probably. He's a fantastic artist.
Yeah, he doesn't
do a lot of work.
Kind of art that looks a little bit like old retro comic strip art from the 30s and 40s.
Hyper detailed.
Jeff Darrow, or I'm trying to think of some of those other Jeff Darrow types. Who's the guy who did New X-Men? Frank Quitely.
Yeah.
If you like Frank Quitely and stuff like that, his is like Raphael Grandpa is like a little more stylized, a little cartoonier, but like he puts that same level of detail. Oh, and also who's the guy who did Godzilla Half Century War?
James Stokoe.
James Stokoe. Yeah. All kind of at least somewhat in the same ballpark of these hyper detailed artists. And this is kind of a, I think of it as if it were like a European graphic album.
This is part of their Black Label, so it's essentially their Elseworlds.
Yeah, it's, you know, honestly, it's a grimdark Batman. It's fascinating with both the gadgetry and darkness of Batman's world, but it has an interesting villain in it who's like kind of got a motif involving like those old like kind of weird black and white cartoons, like the creepier side of the Betty Boop era of cartoons and Steamboat Willie.
Well, it's also a little bit of a wrestling of like Batman and Bruce Wayne's personalities, kind of which one should be the primary, which should not exist.
Right. Alfred, as always, is kind of like, hey, maybe a little more human. And Batman's like, no more Batman.
More Batman. More darkness.
What kind of drew me in on this was, honestly, is the sort of the action sequences in it are very well constructed. I actually kind of, I'm interested to see where he wants to go with stories about, like, sort of class inequality and stratification and stuff like that is a little bit baked into the story too. It's sometimes I'm like, it was a little edgelordy.
Yeah,
but because I also felt like it had a little bit of the unique voice of just like one guy's vision of it, it had that fascinating kind of draw.
You know what it reminded me a lot of is Batman Year 100. Paul Pope.
Oh yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I was thinking a little bit of Paul Pope as well, and you know,
Pope got into the design work of like
right. He was like, here's exactly how the like little, you know, the grappling thing works, and the God, I don't even know those little.
Well,
clamps.
He did the Batmobile and stuff, like various things that were very meticulously planned and thought about, and that is kind of what I get from Raphael Grandpa.
For like, sure, he's like seems to have had fun imagining. Like yes, it's a dark world, but it's also the gadgets and stuff are pretty cool, and I think it's almost like you can feel his excitement about him.
Yeah, I found just it wasn't just the action and stuff. I really liked the way he drew Gordon, and just like the backgrounds and Gotham.
I mean, it's so meticulous, like
gorgeous.
You're gonna want to flip through this, even if you're not in a Batman mood. Give it a flip through.
I agree.
Yep.
So that is Batman Gargoyle of Gotham.
Then we've got Creepshow 2, number 1. This is the anthology series from Skybound and Image.
Boy, you know, when you bring Garth Ennis on, I guess they just let him go. Because that first story is messed up. People who know Garth Ennis, I'm not even going to say what it's about. But if you know Garth Ennis, you know that he likes to poke at, like, touchy topics and things that might make you grossed out or uneasy. Well, he does it again.
It's a good two combo of it's Garth Ennis, and then the second story is Phil Hester.
Yeah, Phil Hester, an artist we've always liked. He's probably best known to most of you guys as the guy who drew Green Arrow when Kevin Smith brought Green Arrow back in the early 2000s. But he's also a solidly talented writer, and he's got his own story about a where there's like a is he a scientist or I forget, but basically there's this sort of fringe notion that there was a secret sort of predatory creature that has covered its tracks and preyed on all the other seemingly dominant species throughout time, but that there is like this secret creature, almost like a bug from Starship Troopers, that's out there ready to take us down and like end the human era.
It's a fun little story.
It's fun.
And we didn't talk too much about graphic novels. Well, actually, Dave, you mentioned James Stokoe. Forgot there was that Godzilla by James Stokoe hardcover.
Yeah, it collects two things: his miniseries Half Century War, which was a cool concept piece about I think it's a woman, right?
I don't remember. It's a Japanese tank commander.
Oh yeah, you're right.
First encounters Godzilla in the 50s, and then over the course of
we see him about
older.
Every decade as he his career in the military leads him to occasionally confront and have to deal with Godzilla again, to the point where it's like. He feels like almost like that Godzilla, this like almost some karmic thing or something. It takes on this existential component in his life. Yep. And you're like, I think Godzilla thinks you're just a bug, man, or doesn't think about you at all. But that's what the story is about, and it's pretty cool. The artwork, of course, is the other main reason to be there.
Yeah.
It's insane. And then he did an issue of that series, Godzilla in Hell. And it was I believe that was a silent issue, maybe, of Godzilla in like sort of Dante's Inferno type hell.
Yep.
Which with weird punishments, but like, oh, how would you punish Godzilla? Well, you'll find out.
Make him eat lots of donuts. that's Homer Simpson.
Ballpark.
This week, there's a bunch of graphic novels as well. We won't get everything, but I know we want to mention the dueling biographies, I Am Stan and Jack Kirby, Epic Life of King in Comics.
From the same guy.
Same creator, yeah.
Tom Scioli, who you might know as a kind of underground and independent artist who draws in a Kirby pastiche style, sometimes making it a little bit more indie, but like...
I feel like, didn't he do Fantastic Four Grand Design after the X-Men Grand Design?
He did. Yes.
I think, yeah.
And this is like a comic book biography of each of them. There's footnotes in the back. They both look to be good faith, as far as I can tell, takes, which cover both the fame and the controversies around, like, Kirby and Stan Lee. So yeah. It will call into question, you know, like, the question of credit as it came up for Stan Lee, or, you know, Kirby's various heartbreaks and trying to get his original art back. Mm-hmm. But it seems like it's also sensitive to both of them, and I don't think it's looking to, like, throw either of them under the bus. Stan would be the more obvious candidate, I guess, if they did. But I actually, the more I flipped through them, the more I liked what I saw, and I'm intending to read both of them at this point.
It's an impressive feat. Those are not like short little books either.
I think these have been in development for a while.
Yeah.
I saw like there's stuff in there covering all the like I think there's you know stuff covering when Stan Lee was trying to negotiate the earliest movie deals in the 1970s to when he like put his name on the line for Stripperella. That had what was Pamela Anderson? Yeah, yep. There's all these little elements of his life, including also stuff with his marriage and things. I saw there was a bit where she was like, "I don't like the beard you've got, Stan," and it shows him having to like shave his beard off in the 70s and stuff. Like, so it's a pretty deep dive. I'm excited to check it out.
There's also a new volume of Jed MacKay's Moon Knight, which is always good.
Yep.
And the Penguin Classics line, which I don't remember from, I believe, last Christmas. They do hardcover, softcover. It's a selection of, like, early Marvel stuff.
Yeah, like, yeah. So, and the previous ones were, like, they did Black Panther,
Captain America, and Spider-Man.
And what you would do is, you would get, like, maybe, say, a dozen stories that were not just the first 10 or 12 of their stories, but, like, several of the early ones, including, for sure, like, first issue of Spider-Man and stuff, mm-hmm. but also landmark stories. So they might jump around a little bit, but it's, you know, roughly going to be probably from the first several years of the character.
And have, a Blu-ray commentary kind of style.
There are little essays, sometimes, mm-hmm. like, a big introduction that was kind of, like, from somebody who's, like, some kind of professor of, you know, pop culture and pop cultural studies and things like that. But that kind of situate them. These are like really good gift books.
Yeah.
They're on a nice paper. They reprint them with great color. And the new ones are, what is it, Fantastic Four?
Avengers and X-Men.
So, yeah, if you are looking for like to do a little early holiday shopping, all you need to do is figure out which of those characters somebody is into, if not all of them.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break. We're going to come back and talk about a lot of trailers. We've had a few weeks where there hasn't been a lot of trailers or anything like that, but all of a sudden there was like the dam broke.
They all arrived. A lot of scary trailers. Not exclusively. Yep.
Maybe they've all been holding out, waiting for the strike to end, and then realize that's never going to happen.
They're like, it looks like corporate greed is trying real hard to hold on to its power.
Let's run these down a little bit. Let's start with a video game trailer for a game on the Switch called G.I. Joe Wrath of Cobra.
We have to cover this, of course, because we're all old-school G.I. Joe fans. And this one is a full-on homage to the cartoon era, to the point where they somewhat recreate the opening of the cartoon in new animation, but a little more tongue-in-cheek. The rock and roll playing in the background is a little America, fuck yeah.
Apparently it is the composer T. Lopez from Sonic Mania, TMNT, Shredder's Revenge, Streets of Rage 4, and Crush 40's lead vocalist Johnny Gugliel, who did Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, Mario, and Sonic.
I thought that was his voice.
It all fits. If you listen
to it, how could we be? How could we even think
it's got these
else?
Very heavy metal guitar licks? And,
yeah,
yeah.
But the actual gameplay of this is an old school 80s beat 'em up style with kind of updated modern graphics and stuff. But you're like Duke and Snake Eyes and stuff going through beating up Cobra Troopers.
It felt very much in line with like the X-Men arcade game.
Yes, for sure.
Ninja Turtles or Simpsons.
But with that kind of deep dive into the visual style of it, so that it looked like, you know, they were going through Cobra bases. There was that snake armor that you could. That was a toy I had and stuff like that. And they're fighting those guys. I'm sure you can get weapon upgrades. And
yeah, it looks like you like picked up like floppy disks.
Yes,
to,
little floppy disks
for
that,
gearing up.
Yeah,
or
probably
something.
Gives you gear tech points or something like
and
that.
And I saw that if you played Snake Eyes, you also got Timber, which was very cool.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up on games like this and Final Fight and all this other stuff. So this kind of side-scrolling action,
we're gonna have to play it, y'all.
I think we're gonna have to.
That's just all there is to it.
Did you ever think of the name of the side-scrolling kind of like action hero game that was like from like 5 years ago?
Yeah. Oh man, it was.
Because I think we all ended up playing that.
It was
a blast.
Like, was it like a,
it was Bros.
America
it was
Falcon.
Kind of, it was some kind of Bros thing because you could because everybody was like Rambro and they were all named.
Oh right, it was. Yeah. It was Rambro. Right.
Even if you played a female action hero, like, but yeah, like all the heroes in it were an homage to. It was Ash from Evil Dead. It was Sigourney Weaver from Aliens. Like you were only playing like 80s, 90s action heroes.
Broforce.
Yes. Broforce was a little sort of a little minor but very fun indie game that I think a fair number of people played. And if you haven't played it, it's still worth your time.
Oh yeah, it's a blast.
But this looks like it's in that same spirit. It's actually like the gameplay itself doesn't look kind of particularly campy, except that it evokes an older style. But yeah, it looks fun. I want to know who the character lineup is so we can determine who will play.
For sure, Duke, Scarlet, Gung-Ho, Snake Eyes. That may be it.
Or does it have like 8 guys and you can swap out?
Maybe so. Who knows?
Because
why are you badgering me, Dave? I don't know.
What if I want to play Snow Job?
Well,
Snow Job, who mysteriously is in a lot of adventures that aren't in the Arctic.
anyway,
but it looks fun.
It looks fun.
And we recommend, I think, watching the trailer, if only for its... It seems to have what's probably the animated opening of the game for about, like, a minute or so, and then really just probably, like, 20 seconds of gameplay, but it looks fun.
We watched the trailer for the new Miyazaki movie, The Boy and the Harem.
Yeah.
Which looks like maybe it's about death.
Yeah. I think so. I don't know what all is going on. There's a little kid who looks very serious.
Yeah.
And, like, even angry. And you see like some part where he's like, is it in the present? They were in what looked like a Japanese structure, but like I saw women in kimonos and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I never 100% know until I watch an actual Miyazaki film.
He's
what
done
is
lots
going
of period
on.
Pieces and stuff like what do you call it, Princess Mononoke, which is. You know, all but like a fantasy setting.
Yeah, from what I understand, this is his last movie that he's...
I think he also somewhat famously has had a few last movies.
Yes.
But
definitely, I think...
The unique thing I know before it, the way it was released in Japan, was there was literally no promotion whatsoever, not even one trailer.
He didn't
want
it.
They just put it out.
Yeah.
And it's like his reputation alone made it this massive success. I don't honestly know anything about its overall reputation or quality, but it looked cool. There was some very trippy stuff in it that happened.
The visuals in this is akin to like...
Like somebody melting, and but also like these very beautiful sequences.
Spirited Away had some kind of craziness. People turning into pigs. And
I would say it evokes some of that. And I don't know if these are transformations related to death or what, but there's like a sequence where somebody has what looks like hundreds of frogs or toads kind of like... enveloping their body, kind of like climbing up and covering them up. And, I don't know what it is, but I think he's always, I think, kind of like the idea that magic is sort of stranger than we think it should be. You know, like he doesn't want it to just be some conventional, oh, she casts a spell. It's like, it needs to be visually interesting and unusual and feel magical. So although I know very little about it, I think that's probably an okay place to be.
Yeah.
I want to see it.
I don't think I've seen every single one of Hayao Miyazaki's films, but the ones I have, I mean, he's made such a mark on, like, I mean, Kiki's Delivery Service,
Totoro. My very favorites are honestly from the 80s to maybe early 90s span, and they tend to be his kid stuff, like My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service,
You like the thief one, right?
I love Lupin. The third Castle of Cagliostro is what the movie is called.
Yeah.
If you haven't ever seen it, it's actually like one of the coolest action movies ever, I think. And it doesn't feel like his other stuff, except in a few points.
I had a huge fondness for Princess Mononoke.
And really, that's around when I stopped being interested. Like, it was almost too dark for me, but it's very well done. And I've never seen an arrow take somebody's head off like that before.
Yeah. If you told me that this is being his final movie is like about a boy coming to terms
it's
with...
It's not his final movie.
I mean, I think he's
pretty old.
He's pretty old.
He's not going to make his final movie until he drops dead in the middle of making a
he
film.
He is
this
clearly
retired
that guy.
Like four times.
But I think it might actually be.
Yeah. But if you told me that this is about a young boy sort of coming to terms with death, about something along
it
those
seems
lines...
quite... appropriate as a final
movie. Yeah, that would feel appropriate.
Yeah, it does. It feels like the work of a late in his years.
But I'm here for it. I'm excited to see it. I don't know if it'll...
The animation all looked very high quality, of course. But yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Then we've got the newest thing from Taylor Sheridan. Lawman Bass Reeves.
What did he have? Like a free weekend? He's like, I'm going to go create another show.
Him and David Oyelowo.
Yeah.
I don't remember where I know him from, but I know I know him from something.
Oh, man.
He's the co-writer, co-executive producer, all that stuff. But this is about Bass Reeves,
the historical African American lawman of the Old West,
who is supposedly Lone Ranger's based on.
Right, although I've heard that could be fully apocryphal.
I've heard this as well.
Did that come up? That came up. That was a point of plot in the Watchmen TV show, which I thought was a very cool, very well used. I thought, but also the same way that weirdly that drew some attention to the what do you call the. Tulsa Massacre? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, Watchmen. Yeah,
that called attention to that. Also, I don't think too many people knew about Bass Reeves prior to that, and then suddenly that was back on the radar. Yeah. And but this looks like a fairly serious retelling, no doubt, heavily stylized, fictionalized, etc. But
he's done a lot.
I think he's done a lot.
Biggest thing you would... I mean, he played Martin Luther King in Selma, which was
that's
like
probably
the,
his biggest thing.
His
that's
biggest.
Pretty big.
But he's been in a ton of stuff, actually.
I think I've kind of come to the conclusion that Taylor Sheridan can produce any show, and I'll at least give it a shot.
I think so. You and I both finished up Lioness, thought that was really good.
I mean, honestly, it's one of the best things I've watched this year.
The only thing I haven't watched yet is 1923, which I just haven't gotten to yet, and Yellowstone, because it's such a bigger commitment. It's like four seasons.
That is his most iconic one, probably, right?
That's Yellowstone. The first thing he did. I think the first big thing he did. But everything I've watched from him has been really good.
I like his idea that shows don't have to be multiple seasons. It can just be one and done, and you get what you get.
Oh, so you're doing that?
Well, I feel like that's what Lioness is. I mean, you could do a second season.
Do you feel like it's sort of finished?
Yeah, I've told the story.
Mayor of Kingston was kind of similar, but they just see a second season. They're still talking about doing more 1883, which I think would be a mistake.
Oh, I heard that was shut.
Maybe because of the strike. But they were talking about doing more of all of it.
Oh.
So I think it just kind of happened that way, which is good, because I think most of his stuff is good one-season stuff. But it's all... the writing is so good.
Yeah. And he gets so many good people. I mean, Donald Sutherland is in here. There's a few other people that you're like, oh, they got that. I mean...
But yeah, it is a story of a federal deputy marshal in the Wild West, and it looks great.
It intercuts his swearing-in ceremony with little glimpses of his life, and also, like, clearly, I think, stuff that comes after the swearing-in. But some kid says, like, are you a sheriff or an outlaw or something? And he's like, a little bit of both, I reckon, or something like that. And since I know literally zero about the character, not that I would look to this really for historicity, but it'll be interesting to see
you'll get the broad strokes.
Yeah.
The next thing up is the Apple Plus series Monarch: Legacy of Monsters.
right? If you've watched any of the recent Godzilla movies, and I say recent, like, what, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, Godzilla, King of Monsters, Godzilla vs. Kong, Kong Skull Island.
Monarch recurs throughout them as the Godzilla hunting guys.
Yep, yep. They're like the government's secret organization that tracks all these monsters and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And then Skull Island, it was headed up by John Goodman.
John Goodman, who reappears in this series. It's going to be it's going to flash back to their heyday in the 70s. Yep. With John Goodman and Wyatt Russell.
Yep.
And then in the modern day, Kurt Russell is playing the character that his son is going to play. And they're going to be doing like some modern exploration of what Monarch turned into.
And like most Apple TV products, the production value...
It looks expensive.
It looks really expensive.
Got one of their monsters are in it. Like, it is... Yeah,
I mean, they might kind of parse it out and like show, like mainly focus on the human characters. But this trailer did not look like they were chintzing out on the monsters at all.
In the same way that I've been kind of interested in, like, I'm not a big Godzilla guy. I liked some of the recent movies okay. Only Kong of Skull Island did I think I really had fun with.
Yeah.
As a show, in the same way that I was kind of interested in whenever it happens, the Alien TV show.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you'll get a different pacing and a different vibe. And maybe some depth on TV that you're just not going to in the movies. And so, even though I'm not big into these movies, I'm kind of interested in the show.
I'm in the same boat. Because, Skull Island is my favorite of them. There's stuff I like about all of them, but I've seen all of them exactly once.
Yeah.
But the Monarch stuff I've always interested in. It's always my favorite part.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of excited to see
this. This is interesting to you on, like, at least two fronts, then.
It's in the X-Files
thing. The TV thing, and then also the kind of secret heightened organization, this sort of... Super science guys.
Right. We got a couple horror shows that are coming out in October. First is Pet Sematary Bloodlines.
Right.
This is a movie.
Prequel.
Oh, it's a movie?
Yeah.
I thought it was a show.
No, it's a straight up movie.
Oh, so this is on Paramount Plus.
Yeah, they're just releasing it on Paramount Plus.
I thought it was a TV show.
I thought it so too, but when I looked it up, it's like a 98-minute movie.
It sort of makes better, actually. Sense, that you wouldn't stretch it out. But
so this is supposed to be a prequel to the previous, recent Pet Sematary.
Which I don't think was exactly beloved, but maybe not hated.
It made money.
Yeah, okay.
It was one of those that did well enough that...
Things can make money. I
mean, I saw it. It was fine.
Okay.
Famous,
like for people who haven't read the story, he's a doctor.
Yep.
And he moves out to the country to start a sort of a practice in a nearby city.
His kid gets hit by a car.
And he also befriends like a kind of an older guy who lives out in the area. And really, the King's writing shines most in the book about their friendship.
Yep.
Like the first line in the book is something like, this character, who's in the prequel, Judd, whatever it is, is the person who should have been his dad. And I always thought that was a great opening line. And but when his son dies, the doctor's son dies, he's like, has heard about this pet cemetery where you can bury something and it can come back. And it is the classic Indian burial ground kind of thing. Which needs probably a little tweaking nowadays.
Monkey's paw, burial ground. Yeah. It's a kind of, yes, you get what you want, but not the way you think.
They don't come back quite right. And, and Judd tells him not to do this, but he does it anyway. And Judd, in doing so, relates a story from his own, like when he was younger, about having somebody else who did tried it with a person.
Yeah.
And this prequel will dramatize that. Yeah. It's a solid trailer.
Super excited for it because this is like a lesser King for me.
Right, same. I agree. I don't think I'll see it, but like I'm like as trailers go, solid.
Yeah, it was a solid trailer.
Is there any notable actor in this one?
David Duchovny, right?
David Duchovny's in it. Pam Grier's in it.
Right.
There are a couple of people that were notable, and I can't remember. I just looked at the lineup.
It's going to be like a period piece, right? Is it like maybe set in the 70s?
69, I believe.
69, okay.
Nice.
Jackson White plays the main character. Henry Thomas is in it.
Okay, all
right. That guy's in everything.
Samantha Mathis.
Okay. I don't think... this is probably not one I am going to see, but if people said, oh, you know what, it's actually pretty good, or better than the previous Pet Sematary or something, I'd be like, oh, okay, I'll maybe... Maybe. It's possible.
It's possible.
Pig.
The other trailer, which actually is for a TV show, is The Fall of the House of Usher, the new Mike Flanagan on Netflix, the final Mike Flanagan on Netflix.
Yeah, I was going to say the last one.
You might know him from such shows as The Haunting of Hill House, Haunting of Bly Manor, or Midnight Mass.
Yep.
All
great.
What's that?
All great shows.
Honestly, yes.
Yeah.
And then the other one that he did with the
back. It was like a YA thing. It was actually not so much.
I'm
going to
bring that up, Nick.
So that was not as great.
You have to do the pluses and the minuses.
No. We're trying to sell it.
Are we?
I don't know.
Anyway.
But I think we all like Mike Flanagan, right?
Yeah.
In general.
And he is a Stephen King, Edgar Allan Poe fan. This is going to be... It is based on The Fall of the House of Usher, but it's clearly a, like... remix reinvention of it.
Right.
There's also Raven, a reference to Raven and some other stuff.
Mask of the Red Death is in there. I don't know if I saw it particularly in this, but I know that his detective, Poe's detective, his Poirot, his Holmes guy who was somewhat Holmesian.
Yeah.
He will also play a role in it.
Yep.
And that makes sense because what I did not know about this one is that the Usher family is explicitly a crime family.
Yep.
And it is once again, he always does the ensemble cast.
Yep.
This is a family that reminded me of a larger version of the family from, like, Knives Out.
Yeah.
Which is to say a bunch of wealthy, sort of
schmucks.
Self-involved schmucks.
Yeah.
Maybe some decent people in there.
Maybe.
Or decent parts of bad people. I am sure there's going to be some really... intriguing bad people.
The head of the family is Bruce Greenwood, who never does a bad thing.
He's great. And he was also one of the leads in... He's been in another Flanagan production, at least one.
Well, he was the corpse
Oh, God. What's the one?
The one on...
Gerald's Game.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did great in it. Carla Gugino, who
also
was in that,
Game.
Also in this.
She seems to might be the...
She's like a vengeful spirit or something.
Or demon or whatever. Yeah.
And so there's a certain pop, slightly darkly funny vibe to this trailer, which I didn't expect. It's generally... A lot of his stuff is kind of melancholy and sort of tragic and sometimes beautiful. And there's very, very high character drama and all this stuff. This is the first one I've seen that kind of looks like a little, like, more fun, almost.
Yeah.
This is the thing I'm most looking forward to.
And it's an interesting tonal change. I don't know how much the trailer represents exactly the tone of the thing, but I think that's fun.
Has he ever been kind of pop? I mean, Gerald's Game had a few moments.
I always think of his stuff as kind of poppy, actually.
It's not art
house. This stuff isn't morose. It's not...
But it's also, like...
It has an element of morose.
You would say that what was the mystery movies I was just Knives Out.
Yeah.
Knives Out is more pop.
Yeah.
And
for
this
sure.
looked a little closer to that than it was to say Haunting of Hill House.
Manor. Yeah, that's fair.
If you did a trailer for Haunting of Hill House, it wouldn't have the kind of staccato pacing that they did in this. And there's lots of darkly funny lines in this.
Yeah.
So there's like somebody who's in there's like clearly a family dinner.
Yeah.
And somebody is talking about, like, maybe the family lawyer or something like that, or the consigliere is like, you know, if somebody gets in the way of our family, we'll have them removed or eliminated. And somebody's like, by that you mean, like, legally defeated and left penniless? And they're like, no, we'll have them killed. and there's a lot of darkly funny stuff in it.
I guess his comedy did kind of bleed in Midnight Club, which...
Yeah, there's a little bit of that with the kids in Midnight Club.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a very fun trailer.
I can't wait for this one.
I'm super excited for this.
Lots of, brief glimpses of scary things and corpses and that Mask of the Red Death thing with, like, looks like the skin that's fallen off of people.
Yeah.
I don't know how it's going to be used in story. How are they going to work in the Raven? You hear him say Nevermore, but what does that mean in that? There's got to be a Lenore in it.
Yep.
How much of the Fall of the House of Usher is a cool story, but it's a very specific story, and all takes place, I feel like, it's not one night, but it's over the span of a few weeks.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm very hyped for this.
Yep.
Yep.
We all, I think, expected that. We did not expect was the trailer for Totally Killer, the movie on Amazon from Blumhouse.
Yes.
Starring Kiernan Shipka from Mad Men and Sabrina.
If you've seen the Blumhouse kind of like slightly more pop thrill horror movies, Happy Death Day. And the other one, what's the one where
Vince Vaughn and
it's one of those like mind switch stories.
It's not just called Freaky.
It's called Freaky. Yeah,
yeah, where basically a Jason type killer swaps minds with the like final girl.
Yeah,
yeah, and a very funny and, you know, kind of dark comedy, horror kind of plays out of it. Both fun movies, not great, but very fun. This seems to be another one in that range, vein. It is Back to the Future horror, I guess I'd say.
Yeah.
In which a girl from the present ends up in her mom's 80s era, and her mom had survived, like...
She's been a final girl.
She was the final girl.
Yeah, it was like three of her friends were killed.
They were serial killed, by some slasher or something, and went through strange machinations. She transports back to the 80s, the daughter, and finds, just like Michael J. Fox found his mom wasn't exactly what he expected, that this girl's mom is like, I can't believe the 80s are over and I haven't tried cocaine yet.
That wasn't her mom.
No, that was somebody else. In the 80s, yes. Though. But there is a lot of, like, it's 80s turned up to 11.
Yeah.
All the crazy colors, big hair.
Yeah.
Cocaine, drugs.
Weed,
yes.
There's a lot of good
one-liners. Somebody is complaining. This is a Red Band trailer, yes. By the way.
Yeah.
Somebody is complaining that the 80s weed sucks so much more, and she's like, I have a gummy in the present that was 100 times more powerful than this. Anyway.
Well, it's one of those ones where the lines actually are funny.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was a really, really good trailer that
it immediately put me in the mind of Freaky and Happy Death Day, both of which I liked, so...
Yeah, I'm definitely going to watch this when it comes on Amazon.
Yep.
And then last thing is Thanksgiving. Eli Roth... As promised, what, 10 years ago?
Oh, more than that.
What is an Eli Roth movie that is good?
None of them.
None of them.
None of them? He's never made a good movie?
No, he was good in Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
Even then, he wasn't supposed to be that.
Did he co-write Pulp Fiction?
Did he really?
Somebody co-wrote Pulp Fiction with Tarantino.
I thought that was Jack Bender or someone.
No, I thought it was Eli Roth.
Well, now we got to look it up because that's crazy.
So he made Hostel.
Oh, you know what? I will say this. I saw Hostel one time because I knew, you know, I had seen Saw, which people, of course, described as torture porn, and, like, the original Saw, written by Lee Whannell.
Saw's good.
Is very good. And James Wan, it's, like, his breakout movie. Not his first, but his breakout one. And then I saw Hostel, and I knew Hostel was not going to be as good because Eli Roth sucks. And but I will say this. It was better than I thought, and not as, like, it wasn't as torture porny as I thought either. It's just not as good as Saw.
Dave, I don't think he worked on Grindhouse, but he is never...
Somebody who co-wrote Pulp Fiction, then?
I don't know, it wasn't Eli Roth.
Nick, can you pull up Pulp Fiction on the Wikipedia?
I can.
And just tell me who it was. I'm sure I was thinking
Dave,
of...
I think Randy is right
on
this
who's
one.
The guy who wrote... who's the guy who played the robber in the beginning? And that's
Tim Roth. Tim Roth.
And then that's probably what I'm thinking of.
Tim Roth.
But there's definitely another...
I'm pretty sure it's Lawrence Bender who's like his...
It could be.
Producer, yeah.
It's possible.
Roger Avery.
Roger Avery, dumbass
from the podcast that they did together.
Yep, that makes all the sense.
Okay,
now.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
We were talking about
Eli Roth. 15 years ago, or whatever it was, there was a movie called Grindhouse, and it had a bunch of fake trailers in it.
Yep.
One of the trailers was for a supposed Eli Roth movie that was one of those holiday themed horror movies called Thanksgiving.
It was a very memorable trailer.
Yes.
This version of it is not as memorable because it's not supposed to be just a goof. It's actually for the movie.
Right. But he did finally make it.
Yeah. It looks fun enough.
It looks fun enough.
I mean, if it wasn't Eli Roth, I might go try and see it.
Yeah, this is one of those, honestly, the kind of, like, exploitation horror is not really my horror stripe at all.
Yeah.
I can maybe dredge up a few, but it's you got to get to like the really good ones, like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like that, before I'm on board.
Right.
And this feels like it's more in that vein, but like, you know, weird creative kills, a satire of like the nuclear family holiday.
Yep.
What's the one? Oh, Krampus had that element in it.
Yeah.
Krampus,
yeah,
not an exploitation movie, really. But clearly was leaning into the Gremlin style. Krampus is pretty good.
Krampus is one of my favorite holiday movies, though.
It's quite good. So Thanksgiving hopes it wishes it was Krampus.
This one is starring Patrick Dempsey and Gina Gershon or Gershon.
Interesting. Sure. Like it looked okay. At some point, somebody whoever the killer is splashes a woman's face in like kitchen sink water and then puts her face up against the frozen door of like a freezer so that it's stuck to it.
And then like lowers the temperature.
So I'm sure she at some point will get her face torn off.
Probably so.
But just as a heads up, that's the kind of movie it is.
Yep.
I will probably skip it and watch.
Yeah.
Follow House of Usher and whatever the one we just mentioned was.
The killer. Totally killer.
Okay.
Totally killer.
I'm gonna lie. I'll probably press play eventually.
Yeah. Next week,
Nick, you tell us how bad it was.
All right. Let's take a break. We're gonna come back and talk about a video game and then a bunch of movies and TV we've been catching up on. Alright, so we're going to start off by talking about Baldur's Gate 3, which I'm the only one here playing right now.
In this room, but everybody else in the rest of the world is playing it.
Right
yeah.
now, literally right now, people are playing it.
You know, before that game came out, obviously there's been anticipation for years, but it didn't seem like it was like any kind of fever pitch anticipation.
And it's been in beta for years.
Yeah.
So it's just like, oh, it's weird. So do you remember watching that trailer? Like, we watched that trailer.
Yeah.
Like 5-6 years ago, maybe longer than that.
Yep, I remember. I was like, "Oh, it was weird." There's like the Mind Flayer stuff. It's going to be horror.
Dragons.
Yeah, it was. It was like 5 years ago.
Yeah,
you could dig up the archival tape of us kind of probably having, I'm going to guess, slightly lukewarm reactions.
No, I loved that video. I loved that trailer.
Oh, did you like the trailer? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
It's a great trailer.
I don't remember it that well.
Man, it's a great trailer.
It's just a cinematic trailer, right?
It is the opening of the game.
Okay,
because basically you start the game with a Mind Flayer worm in your head.
Yes.
You and all the characters you meet, you are on this craft. Basically, the opening of the game,
a spacecraft?
You're on an Illithid ship, which is, they are spelljammers.
Yep.
And it crashes in Avernus, then trying to get away from the Githyanki.
Wait, the Hellplan? The Hellscape?
In trying to get away from Githyanki and the Red Dragons that are probably trying to rescue the Githyanki on board, they wind up going through dimensions and they crash in Avernus. After passing through Baldur's Gate and picking up a bunch of people who they then infect with worms.
Sure.
But, so then you land in Avernus and you have to basically fight your way out, and then you wind up in this area of the coast that's undefined. You're not in Baldur's Gate to start with. You're in this other area.
Okay. The Sword Coast, perhaps?
It might be. And it's not specified.
Okay.
But you build your character, and it's got a very robust character creator.
Yep.
You can do non-binary.
I always like a big brow, brow line.
You can do male, female, non-binary. You can build... there's all kinds of appearance changes. You can do like tattoos and hair color and piercings.
Cool.
And like you can make a very cool looking character. There's a lot of different stuff. And then you pick, it's fifth edition based. So you are using the backgrounds, the races they've got. In addition to the base races, there's like you can play Githyanki. I think that's the notable one. But there's also like there's a drow.
For someone who doesn't know him well, what's the deal with the Githyanki?
They're from kinda, another dimension. They're sort of
they're
like...
kind of look a little lizardy, alien-y.
Yeah, a little alien-y. Yeah.
Okay.
So then you build your character, you put your race in the class, and then you start the game, and you will pick up NPCs as you go along. You have a four-person party.
Right.
Which
was how the classic Baldur's Gate, that goes back to the 90s, went, but unlike that one, which had was essentially real-time when the combat started going down, but pausable... this is turn-based.
This is turn-based. And it is all very... I mean, it's got the 5e move economy, which means you've got move, bonus, and standard actions.
Yep. I watched you play it a little bit, and it reminded me pleasantly, as I was watching that, of XCOM.
Yeah.
But...
There is so much variability in the move. You have, like... I've been playing on past PS5.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically right-click the menu, and it's like little wheels of
the radial
abilities.
Menus, yeah.
And there's... You can throw your weapons. You can throw health potions at your party. If somebody's down, you can throw a health potion. It'll splash and heal a couple people in that area. You can shove people off things. You can jump. There's a lot of different things.
So the action is pretty robust and not like same old every time.
And as you get weapons, you unlock abilities with them. So if you're proficient with a sword and you get the sword, it may give you the ability like to do a pommel strike as a bonus action to stun somebody.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of different stuff that mixes with the classes. So it's 5e plus.
I noticed one thing that it had that 5e doesn't do, but XCOM does, which is if you're targeting somebody with a ranged weapon, it gives you the percentage chance that it'll
yes,
hit.
It
which
does.
Is very nice, and that's a fun thing. You're like, oh, only 60%. Is it worth the shot or
right.
not? That's kind of a fun thing.
But the thing is, they are measuring their percentage as a percentage of the D20. They are using the D20 system. So
right.
You can also have advantage.
Presumably, that's taking into account essentially cover and all that.
It'll tell you if you have advantage, so you're like, oh, it's like a 75% chance. Like,
oh, and the dice actually rolls on the screen, which is neat. You see a d20 roll.
Not for attacks.
Does it not?
Only for...
oh, those are skill rolls.
Only for skill rolls.
I guess they want to keep it moving during the combat, so it's just real quick stuff.
Yeah, it's behind the scenes. It is still rolling, I think. But
very clever.
But yeah. The gameplay is really good. The story mechanics are... I'm on Act 2 just now.
Does it have crits and stuff, I assume?
There are crits.
What happens if you fumble? What happens if you fumble?
Nothing particular. Like,
Sword doesn't explode.
Your sword doesn't explode. Nothing crazy. The hard.
That's good. I hate when my sword explodes.
The Mind Flayer thing in your brain explodes.
Yep, that's it.
But there's definitely a story element of like they're like you should have been turned into a Mind Flayer by now. So there's like there's
a cult. Mystery.
There's a cult called the Absolute that is involved in these Mind Flayer tadpoles. I've been to a Dwergar installation. I've helped a druid grove and a tiefling village against goblins, fought an owlbear, fought a bullet in the Underdark.
Well, I'm going to quick rewind on that owlbear for a minute, because you told me that you went in there and you fought and killed the owlbear, and then you saw that there was a little owlbear cub,
yes.
And you're like, oh no, it's a little baby, and then it goes over and like starts eating the corpse of the mother.
They're not scared to be to be scary with this stuff. There is one point where you find a dog near its dead master. And it was sad enough because we went over and the dog like refused to leave, and you're like trying to like you pet it and that kind of thing. But then I played it split screen with my son, because you can play two player split screen.
Yep.
And he has talk with animals, because all the animals have dialogue. You can talk to every animal in the game.
Right.
And this animal, it's even sadder because he's like, I won't leave my master. You might get back up. We're like, your master's dead.
Oh, man.
But it is very satisfying. You tell him, you're like, well, here's my scent. You can come follow us back to our camp. And then he did show up at the camp later, which was great.
Nice.
And so now we have a dog we can pet every time we go to camp. Also, the camp thing is very cool. You have short rests. You can take your short rests.
Mm-hmm.
But when you need them, like for spell slots, that you do a long rest, you go to your camp, which sets up wherever you are. So if you're in the Underdark, it like sets up this camp that's like in the around the mushrooms and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
But it's got like each of your NPCs has their own little tent set up.
Nice.
And when you actually camp, you have to use supplies to get your rest back. So you have to use all the food and stuff you find to get your
right.
You
so you'll like back. Go through before the actual rest begins and like select click on like, which foods you're using from your
cheese
inventory.
And a sausage and some wine and
right. Essentially, slightly gamified versions of. You know what's abstracted in the tabletop game. They made a kind of like fun little. I wouldn't even call it a mini game.
No, it's just an aspect.
You just quick select them. You know, it's not something that you have to like spend a long time on, but it seemed fun.
Yeah, the magic items, all their magic items are named. Like when you get a sword, it has a name.
Nice. So and it's not just plus one sword.
No, it's like I think my son bought a bow called like Spell Stealer or something like that. And they all have cool little abilities. They've definitely improved upon what I think 5e kind of downplayed the magic item stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Baldur's Gate has a different take on it that I may steal for my D&D games.
What do you mean?
It's like you can still buy magic items, whereas in 5e they definitely discouraged that.
It was more like you could only find these rare things. Yep.
And also like just the notion that weapons all have different abilities and that kind of thing. Like everything if you get this ability, it's like in addition to being a plus one, it has a chance to do Bane, or it has like they all have special abilities and that kind of thing. So it's really cool. You also can change your armor, I found some cool hats you can put on. You put on there's some helmets that they give. There's a lot of different like elements of like min maxing your character a little bit.
Story pretty decent.
Story's great so far.
Good, like good voice acting and all that.
Yeah, voice acting is really good.
Graphics suck though.
It's spectacular. I honestly compare this to sort of Mass Effect and Dragon Age and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really good.
Do you think this is going to attract people to the D&D pen and paper?
I don't know.
Because it sounds like it's very akin.
It's very much like playing D&D with a good DM.
Yeah. I'd be curious to see if that actually drives some business into just brick and mortar stores that.
But it's been a blast. I've not dove into a video game like this in a while, and it's very compelling. And just tons of material.
No.
All right. So, Nick, you have been making your way through Alien and Blade Runner.
Yes. Well.
Well, you've seen them before.
I've seen them all before, but Blade Runner, I watched the director's cut, which I know, or the final cut, I think, is what. Which
but
I know
like
is
the most directory director's cut.
Yeah, which I know is not your favorite, Dave, because of one line.
There's actually a few things in it that I don't like. But it also, like, also, you know, it does some cleanup, it re-edits some scenes and things like that.
I was watching it in 4K and all of the, and on my big screen, and it was very beautiful. And Vangelis is, like, the score is...
Did you ever watch that TikTok I posted a few weeks ago about how they did the layered special effects in Blade Runner?
Oh, no, I don't think I did.
They did this thing where, like, every frame had to get, like a treatment or something like that to do certain visual effects.
Oh, wow.
And there would be some cases where, like, a frame might have, like... It was, like, a dozen overlays in it. They show you kind of how it's done while they're talking about it. It's an insane level of old-school practical effects, but... I will say Blade Runner, I think, is one of those movies that has some of the most effective special effects I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, they hold up really well. And let's see, director's cut on that, of course, has no narration.
Correct.
Tweaks a few lines. Can't remember what all else is in there. Oh, I think they do some digital... In the past, Joanna Cassidy, I think, and it was Zora.
Yeah.
Who gets shot and runs through some plate glass windows.
They
fixed it because otherwise you could see stunt double face very easily on that, especially with digital stuff.
Which, I mean, sure.
Yeah,
but that
was never exactly a big problem.
No, this is just for continuity kind of thing.
Yep.
I like the no narration.
Yep.
There were a couple of things in this one that kind of hit me a little bit differently than previous outings. It's been a couple of years since I've watched it. So
yeah, it's easy to kind of forget just some of the mean potatoes investigation stuff he does, him putting on, like, his little Weasley personality when he, like, has to go into the strip club.
Yeah.
We're looking for peoples.
Yeah. That felt very Harrison Ford-ish. like,
you know what it reminded me of, like, in role-playing games, if you were, like, role-playing a detective, and you're like, I don't know how to role-play a detective. I'm like, I guess he's going to pretend to go undercover and be, like, a little nerdy guy. Like, it seemed a little bit like a slightly over-the-top thing like that.
I've listened to a podcast and sort of talking about Harrison Ford movies in general, and Blade Runner came up, and the idea that he was basically playing kind of a Sam Spade.
Yeah.
Kind of crime noir. And I was like, okay, that's a different take than I ever kind of considered. Because he's supposed to be a badass. And well, he is, to an extent.
He's an effective person at what he does.
Yeah.
Like, at no point is he, like, action movie badass.
No,
he's
actually
more like... I think, honestly, the way a cop would be in the real world, it's like, oh, you close a lot of cases because you have an eye for detail, and you're persistent.
Well, and luck comes into play a lot with him, because, I mean, what's his name would have killed him if Sean Young didn't shoot Leon.
And presumably he was, like, he's retired, like, a lot of more replicants than other people. Presumably those were older models.
Right. They were not the Nexus 6.
When I saw this as a kid, I believe if it was 82, then I would have been 9. Good time to see a guy's head get crushed by Roy Batty.
Very much a show for 9-year-olds.
But it was the first time I had seen a lead hero character who was not very heroic, and a lead villain character who ends up being more empathetic than the hero. Like, that was a pretty wild thing to see, but that is in some ways very noir. It was like, it's meant to kind of noir is meant to upend your expectations.
Yeah. Rucker Hauer does such a good job as Roy Batty, as kind of this, kind of two-faced,
but
he
has the warrior-poet thing going on, where he's, like, sometimes very cutthroat and brutal.
But also sometimes very human and understanding.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Well, he manages to capture that thing where it feels like he's like a child just discovering what it's like to be in love with someone or to hate someone or any of those
eyes
things.
I've seen things. I've seen the Tannhauser Gate.
Yeah.
Very quotable film.
Yeah, it is.
So you enjoyed the revisit?
I actually think I enjoyed it more than I have previously. And that's saying something, because I remember showing this to some friends back in high school, and they were like, bored to tears.
Right. It is, like, in its way, a little bit of an art house movie.
It is. I mean, it's a lot of people, like... I mean, there's violence, but it's mostly people talking in a lot of aspects.
And it defies expectations by not having Harrison Ford be a badass in that traditional sense.
Right. But I love...
In fact, it feels cowardly when he kills a number of them.
Yeah.
They die gorily, you know.
Like Daryl Hannah, especially.
Yes, she has a spasmodic sort of thing.
And he doesn't kill Roy Batty. Roy Batty, like, dies just on his own.
Yep.
And
yep.
But he, I love the scene where he crushes Harrison Ford's fingers.
Oh, man.
And then breaks them back out and hands him the gun again.
Yeah.
And he's just like, do it.
Yeah.
I'm just like, it's creepy. He
is like, again, this is like burned into my brain because I saw it at such a young age. I like both never found like a villain kind of more scary than he was in those scenes. And then suddenly to find him sympathetic sort of near the end kind of blew my mind.
And also I think this is probably the best Sean Young ever.
I mean, if you're willing to not count Hot Shots Part 2...
I think I'm willing to... I think she's just a great character. She gets a lot to do in this, and sort of her wrestling with the idea that she's a replicant.
It's pretty dark, because it's like telling somebody their entire life is made up.
Yeah. And I'm always on the camp that I think Harrison Ford was not a replicant, but I know that's a whatever.
I think the story, I think in some ways, does work better if he isn't. I think the point being that he's lost his humanity, even as these guys have gained their humanity, is a pretty potent one.
Yeah.
There's still also a point about, like, you know, the way people would abuse the system, like, and the idea of, like, you know, it's almost like essentially getting a slave to capture other slaves if he is a replicant. And that's an interesting enough idea, too, but I think the idea was actually fine without that.
Yeah, I agree. So. And that's my thing. I have never seen the final cut or the director's cut. I've only seen the original. And I really love the original, so I've never gone on my way to see the other ones.
I like the final cut, even though there are a couple of changes that are a little bit, like...
Did you not miss the narration?
I never liked the narration.
Oh, see, for me, that is, it's such a noir thing.
I know
Harrison Ford phoned it in that he didn't like it, but it actually worked.
Right, like, laconic is like... That's a noir thing, too.
Yeah.
And it actually gives you a bunch of interesting world-building details.
Yeah. I would miss the narration.
I should go back and watch it.
I can tell you this, Randy, having, like, kind of watched this movie and watched how people reacted to it over the years, it seems like it wasn't until the knowledge that was originally just real close fandom knew of him, like, phoning it in or whatever, not wanting to do it.
Right.
Once that became kind of common knowledge, I'm going to say in the early 90s, well, then suddenly everybody hated it.
Yeah.
But, like, prior to that, everybody was like, I love Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's such a cool
and nobody was ever like, well, I love it except for the narration, which sucks. I was like... I'm sorry to say, it felt a little like they had to be told to hate it.
Yeah. and then on a whim, I watched all the Alien movies, which is, I don't know why.
When you say all, you haven't watched Alien Covenant or Prometheus or...
Those don't exist. Those all suck.
Nick, well, Nothing Past 2 exists, so...
Yeah, once you
so I'm going to make a case for something that does. But the first one is an amazing film.
Yep.
It is such a just a claustrophobic horror film with amazing characters that...
And it showed us sort of blue-collar space in a way I don't think we'd seen
before. Yeah. They were just kind of average...
What year was the Alien?
1980.
No, it was like 78 or 7.
I think 78 or 79. Okay.
Maybe right.
It definitely wasn't... It was in the 70s.
All right.
79 at the latest. But Star Wars had shown, in its way... beat up non-NASA looking spaceships, but not truly blue collar. This was still space opera.
These are guys like fighting for like more cut.
We need to discuss the bonus situation.
Yeah, we need to
as Yaphet Kotto and what's his name? They got some character actors.
It's Yaphet Kotto. Yeah. Who's the other guy? He's like a.
It's Harry Dean Stanton.
Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah.
Yes.
1979.
Okay.
And you have Tom Skerritt as the boss. I watched the director's cut on all of these, all the Alien movies. So the Alien movie apparently drops out like a few minutes and actually is a shorter version of the...
And I don't remember
and,
yet.
And like tightens things up. It doesn't change drastically. There's a few things that like...
Does it include anything about somebody being cocooned, which they did film some stuff about that, but otherwise the lore didn't get out until the second movie?
I don't think so.
Okay. At one point when she's like getting ready to leave the ship, and at least footage exists.
She sees Tom Skerritt.
Does he like kind of cocoon or whatever?
Okay, so that does include that.
That's in there.
Then. And I thought that was a very kind of punctuated scene of like him asking her to kill him.
Okay, so that was the first
use. That was the first use of that. I thought that was very good. The stuff with Bilbo Baggins or Ian Holm as Ash is terrifying. Like, his, like, basically assault on Sigourney Weaver is
I forgot that there's so much, like, psychosexual imagery in it.
Well, she's just, like, talking to Mother, like, their big kind of AI onboard computer. And she finds out about the directive of, like, this specimen is the only thing that matters. Like, the crew is all expendable. And he just, like, is there, like, right next to her. He just appears, and he's like, it's an interesting fact, isn't it? And it's just, like, that
kind of home can play creepy, man.
He's just, like, just so creepy.
But then he rolls up a magazine and tries to jam it down her throat. I wonder if there could be any symbology in there. This was also a movie that would, like, kind of reverse these the normal notions where, you know, broadly, traditionally, sexual assault was considered, oh, that's a thing that happens in film to women and in life and stuff. But here, people, you know, men and women are impaled with the alien tails.
Yep.
It's phallic-like jaws crush heads. It impregnates you with the facehugger. Who's John Hurt?
John Hurt is the guy who is the unfortunate soul who finds all the eggs and tips over into whatever stasis field that the big alien the pilot or whatever. Basically, they had, like, done a stasis field over all the eggs to keep them from hatching, and he breaks it and gets him.
Am I correct that the facehugger that leaps on him does it have to, like, burn through the helmet to get through? So we presume that it's acid blood that it actually can kind of, like, do some limited, like, little excrete it out to just get through.
And that will come into play later in the films as
well. Well, I know, like, when it gets cut, like, it burns the hole through the deck, but I forgot that they can essentially at will do it.
I always forget that the
that would be bad.
The first Alien movie is just one alien.
Yes.
And
did you not?
No. Yeah. I mean, yes.
There's
but
no zzzz on the end.
Well, no, but I'm just like, it's wreaking kind of havoc. It's just like mentally you. I think after watching these movies, you're like, oh, there's hundreds of aliens and stuff like that. But the singular nature of how dangerous these are...
they had to nuke this whole thing to take out that one dude.
Which leads into the second one, which is probably... I have come to the conclusion is my favorite.
Man, it's hard to beat its watchability.
Aliens is absolutely my favorite. Like, I like Alien, but Aliens is like this action movie, like, perfection.
It is perfection.
And it is also, like, I've never seen a group of, like, soldiers or just any sort of small crew like that so well delineated in such a short period of time.
So I have to ask you a question, because I think we've talked off mic about you not liking the special edition.
Yes.
And I can't remember, because I watched it, and I know I've seen it before, but I really enjoyed kind of, like, some of the scenes that I think, I don't know why they that you don't like, basically seeing LV-426 prior to infection.
Big mistake.
Why is that?
Because when they landed on the planet, when they first land on the planet, it's more effective suspense, I think, if you've never seen it at all. If you have no idea what to expect.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I could see that, but
everybody had seen Alien at that point, right? It's a sequel.
Right. But, like, it's just, like, it was complete unknown. Is there going to be one alien? Is there going to be 100 aliens?
Yeah.
You know aliens are going to be involved, but I didn't want to... I don't like seeing Newt's parents and Newt.
But you still... I actually enjoyed seeing Newt a little bit more where she's not,
I mean,
like,
I can see why people would. It's not, like, the craziest thing in the world.
And we still don't know if it's going to be, like, multiple aliens, because it's just the father that gets infected.
Right.
Or gets a facehugger. And then
otherwise it's, like, all you know is they lost contact. But to me, I love that sort of pregnant, like... Well, yes, we probably know what happened, but in no way do we know how it happened or exactly what's happened. Other stuff that's in there, like Ripley, I guess, finding out about her daughter's death is I think, good.
The auto gun sequence, like, that should have been in the movie.
It's interesting because it, like, it shows that their utter relentlessness.
Yeah. I think
and to some degree a little bit of intelligence, right? Because they do eventually pull off... I think at one point we ran the numbers on how many colonists there were and, like, how many aliens were likely killed in that, yeah. Although you got to do some guesstimating.
Well, Burke says there's like 79 or like families, so that is kind of like families in like quotation marks, because that can be
could be multiple people, but yeah. Anyway, you know, there's a movie that has like a great opening. You know, Ripley is rescued and then slowly has to kind of adjust back to a normal life, plagued but plagued with nightmares,
and then gets blamed for the destruction of the Nostromo. And,
right, there's this legal shit coming down on her.
Which is such
like
utter like bureaucracy bullshit.
Right, but it's absolutely what the it would happen now, let alone in the super mega corporate future of Weyland-Yutani.
They're like, oh well, you owe us $9 billion for that giant spaceship,
blew up a refinery, Burke, who like one of the most quintessential weasels in all of moviedom,
I agree.
Who does I think do a pretty good job of seeming at the beginning like he's kind of on her side.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's a great weasel.
He does the thing where he's kind of like, hey, I know I'm a corporate guy, but I'm okay. And you're like, oh, okay, maybe so.
They were very smart to cast Paul Reiser in that, because they Paul Reiser guys who can play very likable.
Yep.
But he can also play sleazy.
Yep. Yes.
And then he was great at both those roles. Like when you first see him, like, oh, this guy seems like a nice guy. I guess he's helping her out. And then when he turns on her, it's like, oh, you son of a bitch.
But it also sets you up to not quite expect it when Bishop is ends up being stand up, and it's like, it's like not every single robot is sort of like a total loyalist to the company or is incapable of some empathy.
And this movie is the basis of why I've always liked Lance Henriksen. He's great in this, but he's just like the knife trick that he does
also Newt should be annoying, but she's not. She's very likable.
Yep.
Well, she somehow survives when no one else could. I mean, she basically is the rat of the station, like going through.
Affirmative.
Michael Biehn did a great turn in this.
Yes.
I mean, he was already good in Terminator from James Cameron.
Yeah. Bill Paxton's Hudson is like
iconic.
Yep. And then they never made any more Alien movies. It's weird.
Yeah, it's just the end of it.
Yeah, just that.
But like epic level suspense, and then like epic level action at the end,
making Sigourney Weaver an utter badass. And she was in the first one to an extent, but this was a new level.
This was Linda Hamilton T2 style leveling up.
Yeah, exactly.
Then came Alien 3, Nick.
Yes,
right,
which was an abysmal movie when I watched it, and I never watched it again. This one included what is called the assembly cut, which apparently adheres closer to what Fincher wanted to do.
One of those legendarily messed up shoots, from what I understand.
Yeah, there is so much. Rennie Harlan was supposed to direct this, then a bunch of others all backed out or fell out, and he kind of inherited a mess.
Yeah, if you told me Alien 3 is a Rennie Harlan movie, that would all make sense.
So
it's being a David Fincher movie that threw me, because Fincher's generally been
good. Well, it's also his first movie.
Right.
This was his, like,
he walked into a franchise movie, and I haven't watched the behind-the-scenes stuff much, but I do know that there was just, like, an epic level of pushing and pulling and stuff.
Yeah, but the assembly cut is 30 minutes longer.
Yep.
It changes things. It changes the intro, so you're not just introduced to the fact that Hicks and Newt died,
in the crash or whatever.
Basically, via a what is it in the original? It's like they show it on a readout or something,
that they
were deceased or something.
Yeah,
you actually see a few scenes and like a whole totally new intro that kind of changes things up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was not in love with the idea of just a kind of another like weird planet, but
it is kind of a singular alien loose among a relatively small population, more in this case, but it has elements of Alien in it, and you know it's hard to beat the original Alien.
Exactly. And it doesn't. It can't beat that Alien.
But I also watched this cut recently, Nick. At least I think that's the cut I watched. And I did enjoy it more on revisit.
I like that there's such a difference in the characters in this cut. They all get backstories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even, like, weird ones that, treat the alien as a dragon and a god. But, like, Charles Dance gets more to do. I didn't even realize Papa, is it Tyrion's Papa from Game of Thrones, Trust Dance? I mean, he basically is Ripley's kind of romantic interest in this until he unceremoniously gets
He's the doctor, right?
He's the doctor.
It's a prison planet. The movie is what's-his-name's movie, though.
Charles Dutton.
Charles Dutton. I feel like it's kind of his movie as the...
He's kind of like the warden, but like kind of the...
He's got like a street preacher vibe to
him. A little bit.
He can like rally people, but he's very... His perspective is pretty bleak.
It is. I mean,
they know they're kind of the ass end of the universe. I never quite bought that the evil corporation would be like, sure, let's fund a bunch of like loser prisoners out here on the edge of nowhere after they had mined the planet or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, but it was like such a small group of, I mean, not small, but
there must be something that they were getting at. Weyland Yutani must have been running some psyops experiments and like,
sure,
let's see what happens to people in isolation. I almost feel like you could do a story about what their secret motivation was.
I mean, the effects on the assembly cut are not 100% finished. There's a couple of shots of the alien that looks a little wonky.
CG-ish, yeah.
And CG-ish.
And it did in the original, too, but...
But there's a level of craft here and a kind of a more interesting look at this world that I was kind of, like, really plugged into it. Like,
What I found that I enjoyed it when I did that, and I was almost watching it independently of the other movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to watch this as this dark movie about a monster in a prison kind of thing. And
well, because Ripley deserved the ending of, like, getting back. She's got kind of Newt as a surrogate daughter and Michael Biehn as perhaps
possible
like a
romantic interest.
Romantic. That's where Ripley should have gone. It shouldn't have that they were killed in a basically an alien. The queen birthed one more alien. And
this is more like, you know what the thematics is more like in Alien 3. It's like the Punisher the End story. He finds that in the Punisher the End, which is like an apocalyptic story, Punisher's like dying of radiation poisoning, and he finds a last enclave of all the 1% guys who've survived, and they. A lot of them did it through, like, the worst, most skeeviest means, but if the human race is going to continue, it's going to be through them. And the Punisher just guns them all down. And he's just like, nope, not on my watch. And Ripley is kind of does that defiantly with the corporation in this. She's like, you're not getting the weapon.
Because it turns out, in this cut, I mean, I assume it's in the first, I can't remember, in the original cut, she was the one who was impregnated by the facehugger on the ship.
Right, and it's an alien queen.
And it's a queen.
Yeah. So a super big prize for them, and an utterly bleak ending.
Yes. This one...
You get this almost weird like sense of like, oh wait, is something going to happen? Because they use Lance Henriksen again, but it's like the guy who they modeled him on. They wanted to give her a familiar face.
Well, and then they have like the Weyland Yutani like troops and like science people who all look kind of like Blade Runner-ish a little bit.
They do.
The aesthetic is interesting. I know in the original cut, like the... When she jumps into the molten lava kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like... The alien burst from her chest or something is kind of one more bullshit thing.
Yeah, did they
and this
that?
One, in a simply cut, she just kills herself.
That's probably better. Yeah, that's right.
I wish Fincher had been able to do what he wanted to do and not have, like, the Warner Brothers or whoever do this step in and kind of like, no, you can't do that. You have to adhere to this. And
I think from what I've seen, you know, there was Once Upon a Time a script by William Gibson that they adapted to a Dark Horse comic a few years ago.
Because he has, like, a writing credit on this, and it
yeah, that makes sense for his first pass or whatever. But, like, his was completely different and wasn't great either.
I need to see if I can dig that up, because I'd be curious.
Related, Nick, I borrowed, but have not read yet, the Alien 3 novelization, because I wanted to see what nooks and crannies it went down.
Yeah.
It was apparently based on the earlier script, like the one that Fincher wanted to do.
Oh, interesting.
And then they're like, oh, the movie we made changed. Could you go and change your book? And I guess the author was like, nope. And so they're like, okay. And they just published it as it was. And it was one of those guys who's like, he's done about, not Kevin Anderson, but it's like one of these guys who's done another of those novelizations.
I'll have to maybe seek that one out just to see. And then there's Alien Resurrection, and man, that movie sucks.
It's not great. I remember when I watched it for the first time about like 7-8 years ago, or maybe 5-6 years ago, was that the characters in it, I think, and maybe some of the dialogue, because I know Joss Whedon did a pass at this, or maybe
he's like full on
screenplay. was that there was some elements of proto Firefly.
There was. It's like a nastier version of the Firefly crew.
Right.
They don't give a shit about each other.
That's a nastier version.
Yeah, it's just kind of like they're sent to basically bring hosts for aliens. And it is, yeah, it is like the eighth iteration of a clone of Ripley.
But with
is
alien
like,
DNA alien in DNA her? DNA,
yeah, because they brought her back that had the queen in her, because they had blood samples from the Fioria, whatever the hell, planet, the prison planet.
Really? Even after the molten lava?
Well, Charles Dance took samples and stuff.
Right, right.
They tried to weave in some continuity.
Okay.
Which is
by the way, made by, I believe, a French filmmaker.
Yeah, it's Jean... did he do the Children of...
City of Lost Children. And Delicatessen.
I can't remember his name.
He had done some, like, these weird quasi-futuristic, surrealist things. By the way, City of Lost Children is a very visually stunning film with a soundtrack that I love. But I've tried to watch it, like, three times, and I've, like, seen it all the way through twice, and I'm like, I don't like it.
Yeah.
I, like, keep wanting to because of the visuals, and I'm like, I like the idea of a weird artsy apocalypse sort of children's fairy tale, too, with Ron Perlman as this heroic strong man and stuff like that, and my like, God, I just, it sucks.
Well, he loved Ron Perlman because Ron Perlman's here as one of his boys. One of his boys who was hitting on a Sigourney Weaver.
Sure.
It's just, it
and
feels
Winona
Ryder's
in it, right?
Yeah, it feels unnecessary.
Isn't she like an android?
Yeah, she's a, she's like a new version of an android that had, tried to weave in some backstory about.
Blade Runner and Alien are kind of the same universe, right? Because they're replicants, they're.
Well, it was revealed in, like, the Prometheus, in, like, one of the files that it was, Weyland Yutani was best friends with the guy who made...
Because I think that is in
Johnny Blade Runner.
In someone's head, someone in 20th Century Fox, it is a shared universe.
Yes.
Right. I don't think people really ever thought about it much until, like, we kind of got to, like, maybe the 2000s era of fan spec. Yeah. Maybe in the 90s there was somebody who did... I don't like the idea because, like, well, any jumbling around at this point is, like, likely to be bad.
Well, in Resurrection...
It does make some sense.
Yeah.
In Resurrection, they
both have, like, evil corporations.
Well, yeah, and Resurrection's supposed to happen, like, 200 years in the future where...
Yeah, that's right.
And they do make a thing that says Weyland-Yutani has basically crumbled and, like, gone bankrupt and stuff.
I mean, I kind of like that idea. That's certainly going
to
happen.
We would be remiss to say that Dan Hedaya is the general of the station.
I saw this years ago. I already forgot that somehow.
Yeah, no, he's... Yeah.
And Dan Hedaya's a hard guy to forget.
Yeah.
This movie is very forgettable.
It is. Somehow, it's extremely distinct... And yet extremely forgettable.
And it should work. The idea of this sort of mercenary crew interacting with the aliens, like, it should have worked.
That's a good, it's a good base concept.
And it's Whedon writing it, right? Like, it's a Whedon script.
Yeah.
It's just,
for whatever reason, it just flops.
Well, right, like, slight art house film director, kind of its mean spirit.
Yeah.
Who's doing the TV show?
I don't remember.
It was somebody good,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, somebody good.
It needs to be Mike Flanagan.
Well, I'm in the mood to watch an Alien TV show.
You play Alien Isolation.
Was that a video game?
Yeah, that's the one that's based on the original Alien and has, like...
Huh.
It is just a singular alien who you have to hide from and stealth away from. Nick, I know you like to shoot your way out of stuff
in
games.
That's true, I do.
And this game is mostly a scary game.
Yeah.
I die
5,000 times in frustration.
Although, I don't know. I'm only a little ways into it, but I just got to the part where you finally confront it. There's cool and scary stuff because there's other people on this... You know that space station where Ripley is saved, like that they take her to with the big spires?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like one of those places where it takes place, and it's pretty impressive, I have to say. Like, it feels like you are walking around in 1979 Alien. Really stunning graphics. But yes, like, you will hide in lockers and, like, hold down a button to hold your breath, and I think it may even do that thing where it's like, if you move the controller too much, it knows, and it means the alien hears the sound.
I don't like that.
Yeah. Mm. It is meant to be a scary game.
Also, H.R. Giger's Aliens...
Goes without
amazing.
Saying, terrifying giant penis heads.
It's true.
Sorry, it is sexual, though, too, with them.
Yeah. Dave, speaking in a roundabout way about Joss Whedon, you rewatched Dollhouse?
Yeah, we put on Firefly in the background at the store a few weeks or a week or two back.
Yeah.
And I was like rewatching it and I was like, "Man, this show is still very good." Like, we found out some things I didn't want to know about Joss Whedon being like a tyrant on the set and trying to sleep with all the people and like being kind of creepy. Not anything quite law-breaking, but not good.
No.
And but nevertheless, I was watching this and I was like, "God, I forgot how good it is." And, like, consistently.
Yeah, the line, like, he gives great lines. Yeah. I mean, his characters are so fun.
It led me to want to watch one of his lesser-seen products that I didn't know as well. And I have actually, I think, seen Dollhouse all the way through maybe twice, which is kind of weird for me.
I was going to say, you don't tend to rewatch.
I don't tend to, but it's short. Two seasons that are only, like, 12 episodes or 14 episodes. And it's, you know, and I've just finished watching season one again. I still like it. I've always liked it, I think, a little more than most people do. It's a premise that is both very good and I also think shouldn't work as well as it does. I think he, by layering in lots of reveals, so there's lots of twists and reveals, I think he makes it good.
Yeah.
But essentially, there's this secret place called the Dollhouse under in New York. New York? It is New York, is it?
But anyway, I think it is New York.
God, suddenly now I have a doubt.
Or is it L.A.?
It's L.A. It's L.A., okay. I think.
Yeah.
That essentially where people will, like, for various reasons, generally sort of in desperation, give over their life for a term of several years during which they will be, like, kind of have their memories digitally removed, kind of a little some Blade Runner memory type stuff here. And you will be replaced regularly with, you'll be kept safe relatively in the Dollhouse, but otherwise you are contracting your life over to them. The Dollhouse, for the generally the wealthy people who can meet their costs, essentially people are sort of prostituted out, or in other ways live out fantasies and stuff, but sometimes they're also like sort of secret agent-y, because they can be imprinted with any personality or combination of personalities.
Yeah.
So they might need like somebody, it's like, oh, we need somebody with daddy issues for this, because we actually want, you know, that on this mission, or whatever. And Eliza Dushku, who was Faith on Buffy, really good at playing the bad girl, plays what do they call their agents? Their God, I suddenly can't say it. Actives. She plays an active called Echo. All of them are based on that sort of what is it? Greek? Wait, is it the Greek or is it just the military?
Yeah,
Echo military. November right, or Alpha right. Beta Gamma, right. All that stuff. And there's like maybe you see like I don't know 20 or so in this agency. There's also like. She has a handler in it when she's out on missions. There's the head of the agency. There's the head security of the agency. Everybody ultimately seems to have secrets in this. And even in the first episode, several of them, some neat things are revealed. Oh, and there's a dedicated like FBI guy who knows about the rumors. Even people around the city know about the rumors. There's actually a fun episode where it's intercut with people like for like a news report on the urban legend of the Dollhouse, where people are talking about it, and some people are like, oh, that sounds completely twisted and disgusting, it does sound like something rich people would do, and then some, like, another woman will say, like, oh, wow, if you could, you know, help somebody fulfill their dreams, and, like, you know, in some way bring them to a better place in the world, then it would be something, it could be magical, it could be great, and sometimes you do see there's these people with kind of decent motivations. Patton Oswalt is in an episode as a tech, like kind of a tech bro kind of guy, or a tech, you know, millionaire, who's actually a decent person, but his girlfriend who supported him through the years of struggle and who actually didn't know that he had just made his million in tech or whatever. She was supposed to, like, he was going to surprise her with the new house that he bought with his first, like, million or whatever. Yeah. She died on the way, and so every year on her birthday, he likes to hire one of the dolls from the Dollhouse to essentially imprint with, you know, memories, her memories, and recreate that moment and get the moment of actually showing his girlfriend, which he never had before, the life that he was building for them. Yeah. And then the FBI detective who's interrogating him on this is like, and then you were going to have sex with her, right? And he's like, well, it is my fantasy. So that does figure into it.
Is the FBI guy the guy from Battlestar Galactica?
Tamo Apeniket, something like that? Isn't he the FBI guy?
Oh, yes, yes. He was... What was his
call sign? He's Boomer's partner.
Yeah. Anyway, that guy.
Yeah. I'm blanking on it.
Yeah.
He does a good job. He's like a physical badass, too, who will eventually run up against Boyd, Echo's handler, yep. in a really good big fight scene
Boyd
in the dollhouse.
Boyd is Harry Lennox, I think is his name.
Yes. I think so. He's really good.
Yep.
But I think what I would say is, like... What really makes it work, for me at least, is that every episode, even the ones that are kind of like Echo's mission of the week, and that's a number of the ones in the first season, they all move the meta plot along and have some kind of big twist or turn in it or reveal about somebody. Like, several people that we think we knew will turn out to be dolls. At some point, you see that, like, Victor, the guy, one of the side characters who played the Russian guy early on,
yeah.
that he always sees somebody that they call Miss Lonely Hearts, who everybody kind of describes as this old woman, like, you know, like a 70-year-old woman who wants to date, like, the boy toy. But what happens is he goes to her house, is dropped off by the handler, he goes inside, and it's clear that there's, like, a sort of a double-blind thing. The woman then, like, when the handler leaves, he goes in another car, and it is, in fact, the head of the dollhouse who is secretly having an affair with him.
Olivia Williams.
And it's like, that's the one person she can talk to, kind of, but with an imprint on.
Well, Victor Enver, what is his, how do you say, Enver Goja, or...
Yeah, that guy.
He's amazing, and so is,
Dyken Lockman.
Yeah. She's Sierra.
Both Victor and Sierra were better actors than Eliza Dushku,
yeah.
who does solid work in
she's
it.
She's fine, like, she's just solid. Not the best part of the show.
Right. But kind of in the same way that Sarah Michelle Gellar not being the favorite character in Buffy, but moved it all along.
Yeah.
I think she does in this, as well. And there's a neat thing that the final episode is quite the shocker in a lot of ways, and they will revisit this in season two because it shows how this technology will essentially run rampant. It just and you know that this is going to happen. This is not a time travel show,
right.
So like it jumps ahead like 10, 20 years, and essentially
it's like apocalypse.
It's become wireless technology. There's a lot of people out there that they call dumb shows that basically it's like their minds have been wiped and they're just like violent, almost zombie-like. The cities are in flames, and like a whole new cast of characters are in it. But because your memories can just be put on a hard drive, somebody, you know, Echo gets imprinted on somebody in that future and starts figuring out what's going on. So she's her memory at least is still alive in that time, and it's a fairly mind blowing bit of science fiction.
My favorite character was always Franz Kranz.
Who's that?
Franz Kranz. He's the technology guy.
Oh man,
guy.
Yeah, Topher.
Topher.
Yeah. Spectacular, slightly larger-than-life character as the programmer who they kind of... Everybody has to indulge.
Yep.
And who later kind of clearly loses it when the world falls into flames because of his work.
Yeah.
I mean, Alan Tudyk plays Alpha.
He plays Alpha, the imprint that's, like, got multiple imprints, super deadly, Joker-like almost, you know, somewhere between a genius and a madman.
Because, you know, Alan Tudyk, he'll play a genius serial killer.
Or a chicken.
But yeah, I had a really good time revisiting it. For whatever reason, it was right what I was in the mood for, and I kind of...
I haven't seen that show since it was on, so...
If the mood strikes, I recommend it.
All right, I think that'll wrap it up for us this week.
Yep.
And we'll be back next time with more, and until that time,
Yo-Cho!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.